This episode of The A-Team is brought to you by FaceToFaceGames.com, Canada's number one source for Magic the Gathering card singles.
You just ask those people to kind of be a little quiet in the morning if they can. Not be like, hey, Alex, 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 wake up.
Yeah.
Did you get the sleeping special? It's like, yeah.
Welcome to the A-Team Podcast, brought to your ears by ManaDeprived.com, home of Canadian Magic.
In 2010, a crack Magic-playing unit was sent to prison by the DCI court for crimes they didn't commit. These men promptly escaped from a federal pound-me-in-the-ass prison to the Canadian underground. Today, still wanted by Wizards of the Coast, they survive as podcasters of fortune. If you have a problem, if no one else can help, and if you can find them, maybe you can listen to The A-Team.
KYT.
He looks at me, are you a pro? Not really, I just have a website. Then he goes, is it a pro website?
Jay Boosh.
They're like, holy fuck, we're both over here, man. We both can't be over here, man.
Scotty.
Like, I stared him right in the face. I'm like, I'm only here for the buys. He's like, so you only want the buys? I'm like, once again, I am only here for the buys.
And Jeremy.
As the 18th fourth member, I promise the listeners that I will get that man to talk more. That is my commitment to you.
And now, the 18th.
Hey everyone, welcome to episode 165 of the A-Team Podcast. This is KYT. I'm back from GB Vancouver, and I'm here with Scott.
Sup?
Jeremy Schofield.
You really screw up my name? Is what?
Schofield? Did I just say that? No, Schofield.
Like, you went like Jeremy.
Oh man, I'm rusty.
You're rusty? You should cast more.
I should cast more, I guess.
Yeah, where were you last week?
Too busy moneying the GP, so I didn't one up you, sadly, from your finals the last time GP Vancouver was around. But I did pretty good. Someone else one upped you though. Someone else.
So
someone
you just had to bring them here and rub it in my face, huh?
Yeah, that would be me.
What?
Jeremy Schofield.
Oh, he actually said the name.
Alexander Hain is on the show, ladies and gentlemen. Pro Tour, Addison Restored, GP Calgary, and now GP Vancouver champion, Alexander Hain. And I won't forget that Japanese GP that you co-championed. That was pretty good, too.
Hey, he played all three games.
Alex, it's awesome for you to be on the show, man. That's fantastic. Thank you for coming on.
Oh, thanks. It's good to be back.
It is good to be back. We are without a Jay tonight, so we had to make sure that we, like, filled the troll hole, as it were, and we felt that, like, nobody can out-troll Jay as good as Alex can, especially when he, like, trolled an entire tournament on Saturday.
I don't know. I don't know about if I can quite troll as well as Jay. I mean, Jay's got to have his crown somewhere. He's the king.
All right. That's true. He's the king of the north. Nice. Well, so you guys all went to Vancouver.
Yeah.
And I didn't. Yeah. So, like, how was it? How was the venue? Guys, tell me all about it.
It was all right.
That is the Alexander Haynes style trolls we've come to expect.
No, but the vet action was really well run. I've been really liking the Grand Prix with without Saturday morning registration. It runs a lot smoother. Like this top eight started at about 3 p.m. or something, you know, and we were done like the first day at a reasonable time to get dinner and then go to sleep. And all, you know, just the round started on time and it was great.
Wow.
Yeah, the venue is the same venue as last time, so it's the Vancouver Convention Center, which. I don't know if it's newish or if it was renovated for the Olympics, but it's a nice big hall. Like, there's food nearby, so it's pretty decent.
There were so many pictures that everybody was taking. It just seemed that everybody was just, you know, breathless from the view. And a lot of the pictures, especially the sunrise looking out over the mountains and stuff, was just stunning. Was it just like as amazing in person?
Well, it's right on the waterfront, so that's always, you know, something. Like, I don't know about you guys, but I'm landlocked, right? Like, I imagine you guys are too. So I see a puddle and I get excited. So seeing an ocean is a whole other story.
Sure.
Yeah.
Nice. So KYT, you got in on Friday, right?
I got in actually on Thursday.
Right, because you had to grind on Friday.
Right. We wanted to get there early, and because we actually, the people that I wanted, the people that I went with wanted to try all the Asian restaurants that Vancouver had to offer, because they certainly are more known for that than Montreal, but even more so than probably Toronto. So going there and everything about that place, can't wait to go back for even non-magic reasons, because it was just beautiful. The weather was nice. I didn't have to wear my big giant coat all the time. So, but I got in on Thursday and so was able to rest up and be ready to grind on Friday with minimal effect from jet lag.
Nice.
I like how you got rest for the grinders on Friday, but not for Saturday.
I mean,
like, he played his grinders perfect.
Yeah, what a grinder. But what happens Saturday night or Friday night?
I think it's because the rest of my crew, like, if I'm going to be serious about these Grand Prix, I guess I have to go alone, because the three of them made it perfectly clear that, like, if you came here to do well at a tournament, you came with the wrong crew. I'm like, okay. So, you know, they weren't excited. Well, I went with my friends Barry, Kenny, and Ricardo, and, you know, they're not the type to be excited about grinding for buys, but Barry already had two, so he was fine. Kenny grinded with me, but Ricardo just didn't even consider it a thought, just wanted to visit the city. So, you know, I was there. I won the first grinder I entered. Bloody Mess Jess was actually part of the same grinder, so it was nice to see her there. But Friday night, hooked up with Kenji, Numat Danami, and we went karaokeing until like 2 a.m. So definitely not a good way to get a good Saturday going, but that's how it worked out.
Now, I understand that Kenji's been taking singing lessons and such.
Yeah, unbelievable. Like, on YouTube, if you check out his YouTube, he's singing one of the main songs in the movie Frozen. And I came away impressed after watching that video. And then he says he's really enjoying these singing lessons. He's getting them like once every 2 weeks or something. So it's really coming along to be one of his hobbies.
Wow, good for him. I mean, he's definitely very talented. There's no question.
Yeah. And he's willing to party. He's willing to throw down. So it was sweet. It was sweet. Of course, you know, I like staying with other people. It's always tough to stay with other people that don't have buys, because getting the sleep in special, like, I don't expect myself to be able to fall back asleep. So even with the two buys, I didn't offer to sleep in special. I'm like, just going to wake up anyways. But I wasn't as refreshed like as I could be, but it was good enough to X1 that day.
Yeah, I find the sleep-in special still worthwhile, even if you have people in your room who are not sleeping in, as long as you aren't relying on those people to get to the site, you know? Like, if you're like, a couple kilometers away from the site, and your driver is at zero bias, you know, having the sleep-in special is maybe not the best decision. But, like, I don't know, you just ask those people to kind of be a little quiet in the morning, if they can. Not be like, hey, Alex, wake up.
Yeah.
Did you get the sleeping special? Like, yes, I did. Oh, okay. Just go back to sleep then. You know?
Yes, thanks.
What tournament was it, Alex, where it's like you had the sleeping special, but they were calling your name like first thing in the morning and I was frantically texting you saying, oh my God, they're looking for you? Was that San Diego?
Maybe. I'm not sure which tournament it was, but actually this tournament was an interesting one. So I got the sleep-in special, and I wrote out my deck list, and I handed it to Brian Zemba, who's staying in my room. He had I think he had two buys, but he didn't get off for the sleep-in special. So I said, Brian, can you give him my deck list in the morning? And he's like, yeah, sure, no problem, right? So I go to sleep, and I wake up to my phone ringing at 8:30 in the morning. I'm like, what the hell? And it's Brian Zemba. And I get a missed call. I'm like, oh, crap. What did you do, Brian? What did you do? And so I call him back, and he's like, yo. I'm like, hey, Brian, it's Alex. What's up? He's like, oh, yeah, I forgot your deck list in the room. So I'm actually writing on my own deck list right now. So can you just, tell my friend what's in your deck list, and he's going to write it down? So I was not too pleased about that. Thankfully, I was playing exactly Saito 75, so I directed Brian's friend, who still, I don't know who it was, this angel who wrote down my deck list, to KYT's most recent article at the time on Mana Deprived to find Saito's deck list, and he copied it down, and Kyle Rick, one of my favorite judges, came to me once I arrived at the site and said, good job getting your deck list in on time. And so I assume that there were some people who noticed that there was a little bit of a scuffle trying to get my deck list in, but everything worked out. And then I got to joke with John Stern, who knew the story in the top eight when we exchanged deck lists, of course, and I'm like, do you like my handwriting, John? Is it very nice and neat?
Wow. So you still got woken up.
Yes. Yeah, I managed to get back to sleep for a little bit, but my sleep schedule was completely fucked. So I was in Sacramento the weekend before for the GP, and I planned this with John. We were going to be doing the two GPs together for the two weekends. However, it didn't make sense for me to come back in the week in between, and John was staying with his brother in Victoria. So I wasn't going to just, stay in a hotel by myself. So I decided to go and visit my good friend Miguel Gattaca in Costa Rica in the in-between week.
Rough life.
Right, exactly. So I left Sacramento on Sunday night at about 11 p.m. and got into Costa Rica Monday at noon. And then, of course, I get there. What do they want to do? They want to party. So Monday night was spent partying. I was up all night. And then 5 a.m., still haven't slept. Time to go on a tour involving hiking up volcanoes and stuff. So we did that all day. So I had there's a nice period of 72 hours without sleep. And then we had another tour the next day early in the morning, and the next day was spent drinking. And so Thursday night, I didn't get any sleep. And Friday, 5 a.m. again, I had to fly out to Vancouver on no sleep and still pretty drunk, actually. Finally got in to Vancouver, 10 p.m. and only managed to get to sleep at 2 p.m. after not having slept the previous night. And then Brian wakes me up at 8:30 in the morning.
God.
So was not ideal in terms of sleep. So I definitely feel what KYT is coming from with the, people who are not planning to do well.
I was hoping to do this contrast where it's like, okay, well, we know what KYT did for prep. What did a winner do, let's not go there. Maybe KYT's on the right path. That's how you get to 11th, right?
Good Lord.
I won't sleep with Jeremy then.
I wouldn't recommend sleeping with Brian Zemba either.
So you guys, so KYT, obviously you were on Mono Black, as we saw, in the, you got featured in the deck tech.
Yeah.
Which was awesome. And then you got featured, of course, for some featured matches, which was good. One of which was brief and one which was a little bit longer, but still brief. And then after that, you got to jam in the booth with Marshall, which is really cool. So we'll talk about that later while I beat you, senseless. but you obviously were very comfortable with Mono Black. Did you make any changes to the deck whatsoever for those of us out there in Canada land and Radio land that haven't actually watched your deck?
No, I didn't make any big changes. So I played Mono Black the whole month, so it's 4 weeks, so three PTQs and one GP. I played John Stern's 75 from his article for the first 2 weeks. And then I went for Brad Nelson's list for the next two, which is basically Owen's list, just with Doomblades in the sideboard. And like I explained in my article, there was no real reason to change. Like, the changes, I feel, probably have minimal impact to how well I did. But I really liked the fact that Brad had Doomblades in the sideboard because of red-green monsters being a more prominent deck than it was when John wrote the article. So I decided I went with that, and Brad had his sideboarding guy, which was more than fine. So I just stuck with it. You know, I did really well in Toronto with it, and did really well again with it. So at the GP, so it's just one of the best decks in the format. There's not much that you can really tweak. Like, people are just like tweaking the amount of Devour Fleshes, and some people play one or two or zero Whip. Like, you know, one of the people that flew with me, Ricardo, was asking me like if I liked Whip or not, and I'm just like I didn't really have an answer. I mean, it's good in the mirror, but it tends to be also too slow against some of the more aggressive matchups. And you're really only playing one copy, so it's hard for me to say something like, yeah, you definitely need one Whip in your 75. But so if there was another tournament, I'd just run back exactly what I ran because I did really well with it. And the matchups I lost were, like, I lost to Matt Sperling in the mirror. I lost to Ben Seck, who was playing Mono Blue. I just, like, mulliganed to actual Oblivion against him. And I lost against red-green monsters when I didn't draw any demons in both games, which my opponent said, like, at any time that would have helped me stabilize and dominate the game from there. So, you know, I felt really good about my 75 going in and getting out of the GP.
Okay. Jer, what did you play?
I ended up...
I didn't ask how we played like. I asked what he played.
Ooh, I think the answer's the same.
His deck was shit. He was telling us that he was also on the Mono Black devotion, getting the sweet list from Marcel, playing Marcel's sweet list. But no, when I hover over Jeremy, he's not playing Mono Black.
No, I was casting Pack Rat followed by Master of Waves.
You did it.
Yeah, so I did. I did stick with that, like Azorius devotion or the Esper devotion list, that GFabs thing. Mm-hmm. I really enjoyed it. I feel like I ran into at least one bad matchup. You know, I didn't get to play a ton of games, so that's kind of the awkward point. I did go in with zero buys, and I started off just like with a win. I felt really good, and then I dropped two in a row, and then I was just kind of like, okay, well, you know, this is going to be a quick tournament for me. But somebody came by and said, well, you know, you're in the best spot because you get to go in, you get to kick people out of the tournament for the rest of the day. Like, you get to be the executioner. So at that point there, I just had a much cheerful outlook on things, and I just went and knocked people out of the tournament for, you know, a few rounds.
Yeah, that's what you got to do. You got to count your number of kills. You're like,
exactly.
You know, round four, you're like one kill, another kill.
I played it like it was an EDH tournament where you get bonus points for killing people.
Nice.
You know, as opposed to winning the game, you just want to kill as many people as possible. Well, no, it was like really awkward because like as soon as like I get to that point there, I end up playing against a guy named Richard Wagner, and he's a guy who works at like the chain of stores I play at, the Warp stores in Edmonton. And he's like a super nice guy, and we ran into each other in a few matches like GPTs and stuff like that. And he's not a super competitive player, but like he'll go to like a nearby GP or he'll like go to Vegas because, you know, it's like a big deal GP. He's kind of like in that boat there. And he's decent at the game, and he does, like, well. Like, you know, he can play a deck and know what's going on. Like, there's certain areas where it's, like, we can have a good discussion and kind of, like, you know, point out, like, where, you know, maybe lines could be more optimal. But we ended up playing against each other, and, like, we played really – it was probably my closest games where it was just kind of, like, haymaker back and forth. And I ended up beating him, and it was just, like, you know, the feel bad, feel good, where it's, like, hey, I'm still in the tournament, but, hey, I just knocked a buddy out. And at that point there, it was just, like, let's just have fun with it. And I ended up playing against another guy from that store – who worked at the store and knocked him out. So it was like, I just was like crushing all the people I knew. It was doing the Cody Crosman where you're the friend slayer.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I did that and I got to the ninth round. I'm 6-2. I'm playing my winning in. I sit down against from Mono Black. Game one, I just pack rat him out of the game. Like, it wasn't even close. It was just like that whole, like, oh, thought sees on one, pack rat on two, make rats win. So that worked out really well. And then game two, He pretty much did the same thing to me. And then game three, we just played like this crazy, like 15 turn game where it was kind of back and forth. If either of us draws an answer, it's over. And the opponent has like probably somewhere like 10 land in play and then drops a pack rat and just like rats out before I can do anything. So it was kind of rough in that spot there where it's like, you know, you're always expecting the early pack rat, but it's those late game pack rats where it's just like, instead of it taking three or four turns for them to hit like critical mass, they just do it the next turn. So that was rough. That felt bad.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, no, it's all good though. Like, that's the thing.
You set up yourself for like, you got all these kills later, and then you set up for kills.
And I was feeling so good because I was like, I was on this killer streak.
Right, and just like, as long as your kill to death ratio, you know, is like pretty
high. Yeah, my KDR was very good. It was not day two good, but it was good. So yeah, it was kind of rough in that spot there. And of course, you know, you lose your first matches and stuff like that. So it's like looking at like the 6-3s that made it, because we did have some 6-3s make it. It's like, oh, look, I'm at the bottom of the list of the 6-3s. Okay, well, that's good. You know, tiebreakers, that's how they work out. If you kill all of your opponents, they stop playing Magic with losing records. So that's how that works.
On the subject of 6-3s that made it. So I was, you know, I was still a little angry with Brian for our morning's mishap.
Yes.
And he finished the day. He started 5-0, but he finished 6-3.
Yeah.
And so we left the site before, you know, checking standings, and we went to go get dinner. And of course, as my usual way, I was trolling him as much as I could.
Yeah.
I was like, you know, like, for instance, John Stern's brother, who hasn't played Magic in 10 years, came to play the GP. John gave him a deck and sideboarding guide and so on, and he made day two at 7-2.
Yeah.
So I was like, you know, hey, Brian, you know, John's brother, he hasn't played Magic in 10 years. He did better than you did.
Jesus.
Like, hey, how tall are you, Brian? Are you 6'3"? And Brian's like, no, I'm like 5-something. I'm like, he's like, how tall are you? I'm like, I'm 8'1". He's like, there's no way you're that tall. You know, he's still didn't get it. But he finally got at one point. He's like, you're such a dick. Anyways, so we're at the restaurant, and one of his friends texts him. He's like, hey, Brian, you made it. He's like, what? He made day two, you know? He was one of the better tiebreak 6-3s. And, of course, I was like, yeah, you know, I was just bringing you down, so it'd be a bigger up when you found out you made it. You know? Good guy, Alex. Good guy.
Absolutely.
Wasn't being a scumbag.
The worst beat was Sponge. I don't know if you saw what happened with him.
He lost to Sam Pardee in the last round, right?
Yeah, so the way that it's he lost to Sam Pardee, and he was like telling like the bad beat story all night, because, you know, he was like, he got me on the 4-outer into 3-outer. But the crazy part of the story is they released those standings 3 times. So it went out once, and then it went out a second time, and then went out a third time. The first time Sponge was 120 or one, what was it? It was top 128. So he was 127th on the first release. Then he was 129th, and then he was 130th. So, like, when it first came out, the standings came out, he thought he had just snuck in. And then, I don't know if people just undropped or something like that to get themselves back on the list. And then he just kind of slid right out of day two. So, I feel like that would be a little bit soul-crushing.
Yeah, I mean, whenever you feel like, you know, you just got there, and then you get brought back down after being down and going up.
Yeah,
that's when it really hurts. Like, in, you know, at GP Philly, I had the worst sealed deck I ever thought I'd seen, and yeah, I somehow managed to start 9-0. I was like, wow, you know, I can 9-0 with this pile. Like,
yeah.
Now I get to do the drafts. I get to have whole new decks and stuff. And then the drafts, like, everything went wrong, and I went 0-5. So I started, you know, really down. Like, okay, I'm just gonna go like 0-3, and then get to chill in the weekend, you know, with my buddies. And then it's like, oh, then you go up. It's like, oh, I'm 9-0. Like, I'm unstoppable. And then 0-5, it's like, ugh. You know? So they're down, then up, then down again.
Trolling my Magic career? Where it's like, I was terrible at Magic, and then I had this one great tournament, and I thought, oh my god, I'm good at this game. And then I'm, you know, the man I am today.
I was trying to be a little more subtle about it.
So actually, you bring up a really good question. Alex, and I got to ask, you've obviously played your fair share of tournaments. You've seen a lot of success in, you know, in a wide number of them. But, I mean, I think we were talking about it just yesterday. You're like, yeah, I only win 1 in 3 GPs or something like that.
Oh, my God.
Tongue-in-cheek comment. But the point is, but what I've actually found really important about that is You've obviously seen success, and you've also seen not success. So can you speak a little bit to sort of what noticeable differences in your mindset? Like, you just alluded to it with that last story, but, you know, are there some pitfalls that maybe you recognize that you or other people fall into that you should be avoiding?
I mean, there's definitely some, like, there's definitely a lot of luck in the game and preparation, and there's all sorts of factors that go into whether a tournament's going to be a failure or a success. But I think you just have to kind of maximize your possibilities for success. And that includes, like, stuff like not tilting, you know. For instance, a good friend of mine, Pascal Maynard, has been known to drop from a Grand Prix while still in contention, you know, just because he was so tilted. And that's not something you should do, you know. I have another friend who I know who used to go 0-1 drop at PTQs. And, like, I think the majority of my PTQ top 8s are when I started 0-1, mm-hmm. you know. And you're just giving up a certain percentage, and you have to basically always just make sure to do whatever you can to maximize your percentages. And a lot of that involves keeping your emotions in control. We're playing Magic. Everybody knows there's luck in the game. There's variance. There's going to be ups and downs. You just have to kind of realize that and understand that and not let it affect you, because there's going to be times when you're down. You have to, you know, just keep going. As long as you're still alive in the tournament, you know, you should just keep playing every round exactly the same. Just give it your best all the time. Like in Barcelona, you know, I was 1-3, and like basically I have to actually win every single match to make the top 8. You know, and I that's what I did. You know, it was possible just because I didn't just drop or something. You know, I just kept playing and kept trying as hard as I could.
Nice. Okay. That's good advice. Thank you.
It's a beautiful thing about Swiss in that, like, for the most part, everyone's in the same position as you are. Right? So it's like, even exactly. Putting that into your mindset, it's like you're not behind, you're not on a disadvantaged foot. The person who's sitting across from the table, you know, it doesn't matter what the standings say, it matters what this match is. You know, you just go and try and have your best match of Magic. And the person sitting across from the table is in the same shoes as you are. They're in the same position. So it just go out and have a fun game. And you know, it's like every person I sat across from was death. You know, I had become death and was knocking people out of the tournament. But they were sitting on the other side of the table, too. Like, it could have very easily gone either way. And in the end, it did. But, you know, like, that's just kind of like the mindset I think you have to be in. And, like, sometimes it's like, you know, the whole death thing, like, that was a way to make it fun. That was a way to make, like, this bad position that I was in fun. And I think that really helped things. I think
so you
really
kill for fun is what you're saying.
I did. Absolutely. Absolutely. I embraced
it. Have you seen professional help?
No.
Have you enjoyed skinning animals as a young child?
No, but I am peeling the crap out of my iPhone case. I don't know if that counts.
No.
No, okay. we'll give you a pass on that. Okay, but guys, okay. Be careful if you see Jeremy in a dark alley. Or if you're exing two at a tournament.
Oh, yeah, that's what we want to hear.
So, we have a pile of questions, but before I'm going to get to them in a second. Alex, you mentioned you played Saito's list. Made no changes. You played the exact 75. You obviously performed very well. In Calgary, you know, we knew you were playing blue, white, red control. Apparently, there were a lot of people that forgot that, you know, since you were engaged in a number of discussions about, is that even good right now? Sphinx's Revelation, is that even good right now?
Sperling doesn't think so.
Yeah.
Well, and Josh didn't think that off-color Skylands were good, but yeah. I mean, you know, to when you're at that level, like, you know, they're both players that I respect a lot, but, you know, yeah. Like, when you're at the top level, you often have to go against what the conventional wisdom is to, you know, to, like, get an edge.
Well, it's that risk-reward, right? Like, it's like, if I play something just a little bit greedier, you know, I have a better opportunity to have, like, this breakout thing. Like, I can also get punished by it. So it's just playing, like, safety, right?
Right.
Like it's yeah.
Also, I mean, you know, I've done pretty well with Sphinx's Revelation myself. Like, you know, in fact, Vancouver and Calgary were my last two standard GPs. And I won them both with Revelation decks.
Yeah.
And I don't think, actually, I looked and don't think anyone else has won a Grand Prix with Sphinx's Revelation. So that's kind of cool.
Yeah. So like, I guess Sperling's kind of right for like everybody except for me.
Oh, okay. So in the top eight, you played against, or in the finals, you played against the Mono Blue Devotion list. You've got the sideboard, like you've got the deck list. You can kind of review it. When you're doing your sideboarding, are you like kind of envisioning what your opponent is changing with his deck? And like, what did you think that your opponent had done with his Mono Blue list?
Well, I certainly did not expect that he was going to be going up to four domestications.
Yeah.
I'm still, you know, I was asked many times about whether I think that's correct or not. I think I can understand, like, keeping the ones he has in the main deck in, but I think going up to four is just, like, it basically the way the game turned out, it worked out perfectly, but there's just so many scenarios where it's a terrible move. Like,
yeah.
Where he doesn't, you know, where I don't have, like, an early angel for him to pressure, or if I haven't gone through three last breath by the point that he has domestication and I just last breath one of his creatures. Or if he doesn't draw his one of negate that game to counter my Elspeth, etc. I mean, I was definitely expecting his gainsays and negate and Jaces to come in. The domestications definitely were a bit of a surprise. And, I mean, it worked out. That game, I think, is basically as best as it could have for him.
Yeah, I thought that he pulled out cards that would have been strong in the matchup, because he had taken out Masters of Waves. Like, he took out all four of the Master of Waves. And he took out the Biden of Thassa. I think that Biden is actually just, like, a really, really powerful card in that matchup.
Yeah, I agree with taking out Master of Waves. I think the cards you're normally supposed to take out in the matchup are Cloudfin Raptor and Master of Waves.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because yep. You basically want to avoid overextension. Yep. And because Blue-White doesn't actually have that much removal besides, like, the Supreme Verdicts. So if you can play one creature and then a Biden or something, you force the Blue-White deck to answer that one creature.
Yeah, so, that's where it's like, that's where your Supreme Verdicting to kill off like a solo Judge's Familiar because it's a card draw engine.
Right, or a Nightfall Spectre or a Frostburn Weird or something. Yeah. And of course, also you get to protect a lot of your guys with counter magic because you have these gainsays and negate and so on in your deck now. And I think that's generally the plan that Mono Blue's been on and why people have generally thought that Mono Blue's favored against Blue White after sideboard.
Yeah.
I do think, however, the Archangels changed that, because now your plan of just playing a guy and playing a Biden is not very good when they just play an Archangel, and then suddenly, like, you're behind on the board. And you have to play, like, at least two more guys, and they're still, like, you know, you're still only getting value if they're attacking you, and you're like, having a Biden to resolve, and it's a different ballgame. So I can understand that, like, bringing in domestications is a bit of a desperation move, right?
Yeah.
Now, it's interesting because I actually got asked, somebody tweeted at me and asked about those angels. Are they going to stay in the sideboard, or you think they're coming out now that everyone knows what's going on? Like, were they really a surprise, or are they like the legit card?
I think they're pretty legit. I think they're very good. I mean, not only in the mono blue matchup against a lot of the aggressive matchups, and I mean, I think even Saito advocates bringing them in the mirror. Which, while I don't agree with that, you know, I can see when people bring out a lot of their removal. But I mean, I think it's definitely the real deal, and it's an excellent plan for the deck. And I'm not really sure how Mono Blue is going to adjust. I think one of the necessary things is they're going to have to increase the number of dissolves they play over cards like Gainsay. But Gainsay is much better in the mirror, so there's kind of some tension there, you know?
Do you think the new Blue Devotion counterspell for them is going to be heavily played or kind of like tick up that rain or what?
It might be. I actually think that, I mean, I haven't looked that deep much at the new set, but from what I've seen, I think it's a little rougher for Mono Blue Devotion with the new set, because Mono Black gets a lot of tools that are very good, like the new Infest with Scry, the -3/-3, and like the, you know, what are the incentives to play Mono Blue when, you know, all your guys are dying a lot more efficiently.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, even Green Red Monsters, which is a list that is generally fairly well, you know, fairly good against a bunch of decks in the field and fails fucking miserably against Mono Blue, gets that, like, sweep your Sky team, Sky Reaping or something, based on your devotion to green.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Which is a nice little tidy sideboard card for that deck, since that's the problem is all the flyers.
Yeah, I mean, the green-red decks getting some help actually is good for mono-blue, because that's kind of their best matchup, I think. So, I mean, we'll see, but I feel like the Angels aren't really going anywhere. I think they're just very good.
And that's the thing, is that they're not necessarily like a new innovation. Like, they're a bit of a known quantity. Like, I think the first time that they popped up was like Vienna or something like that. Sifka was playing them in his blue-white deck. And they've been kind of bouncing around like from like GP to GP up until you kind of like, you know, actually crushed the GP with them.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, I just don't see Mono Blue really having a good plan against the Angels.
No.
You know, but just like, it's hard to deal with like lifelinking flyers when you're playing blue, you know? The removal's not your best thing. Like, you can keep in rapid hybridizations and cyclonic rifts and stuff, but that's just, it's still, you're losing value every time.
Yeah, they have the new blue counter spell. I don't know if that's going to be good. The creature or aura. I don't know if that's going to see any play.
Right, I mean,
in their board, but like, you know, that could be an answer. But yeah, like, it really just doesn't seem like a good place for them. Maybe the answer is side in all your domestications. Who knows?
No.
No.
Like, I'm just going to go right ahead and say it, guys. No.
Especially if blue-white, I think it's more likely that blue-white adopts the counter creature or aura spell into its deck. Because I think mono-blue, you know, doesn't really want to be countering creatures. Whereas blue-white is very happy to counter creatures or underworld connections, for instance, against mono-black. And, you know, I guess you can always counter domestications on your angels. But I don't think mono-blue is going to be playing that card. Certainly not in the main deck, and it's not a card I really see sideboarding against blue-white.
Yeah.
Have you seen anything from the new set that you feel like is actually, like, a good addition to the deck? Like, I don't think Thassa's Rebuff set good, personally. Like, I feel like...
To mono-blue, you mean?
Yeah, to mono-blue. Like, mono-blue devotion. Like, I'm just looking at, like, Horn of the Gods, and I don't see, you know, the card that stands out. Like, mono-black has the obvious things that it's getting. Scotty covered, you know, like, some of the stuff that green's getting. Like, red seems like it has some fun stuff. White has a couple cards. But, like, the mono-blue deck, like, I just don't...
Yeah, I mean, I haven't seen very much that I think would go right away into that deck. I think, you know, the counterspell probably will see a few copies in main decks, but I think mono black looks like the deck that gains the most. I think blue white getting the Skryland is very good, and yeah. I think actually white weenie gains quite a bit. Brimaz will be obviously best in that deck.
Is he the best card in the set?
He might be. I mean, I haven't looked at everything yet, but he's pretty good.
Yeah.
I do love the Skrylands, though, so hard to argue against those being some of the best cards.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I'm really excited for the red-black, and I just want to play more Crystals.
So,
You're off Esper already, Jeremy?
I don't know. Maybe. We'll see. I got a PTQ coming up in a few weeks' time, so...
Play mono black, man.
Yeah, I guess so, huh? With Bio Blight and all
even,
that.
Even KYT could come 11th with mono black.
Yeah, KYT can do it.
So, any changes you'd make to that blue white deck, either out of Born of the Gods or just based on what you played with and was unimpressed by?
No, I pretty much liked everything. Azorius Charm was the worst card, and I think most of my losses were just to. Like not having land drops, so I would consider even adding a 28th land, even though it sounds kind of crazy. But I've played 28 land decks before, and the Skrylands kind of, you know, smooth your draws a bit more. That if you need more lands, you can find lands, and if you need more spells, you can find spells. You kind of like draw half a card every time you play a Skryland.
Yeah.
And I mean, obviously, with Born of the Gods. They're definitely going to find four of the blue-white temple into the deck, whether it's going to be instead of Azorius Guildgate or instead of some of the off-color lands. I'm not sure. I mean, and Brimaz might even find its way to the sideboard. I think having four toughness in the format is going to be important, as red decks seem to get some benefits. So Searing Spear is going to see more play, and of course there's going to be a lot of -3/-3 going on.
Yeah, that's a number that I've been, some of the smaller circles I've been talking about decks and brewing and, you know, what's going to be good on the horizon. And I agree that the four number is really, really a big one. I mean, Mizzium Mortars is really all we're talking about here.
Yeah, and I'm not even sure Mizzium Mortars is that good against a lot of the threats in the format.
Yeah.
Well, it's like if you're playing blue-white and you have red, you're not bringing a Mizzium Mortars in. Like, that's the thing. Like, in the sideboard matchup type thing like that, if you're playing as control, I really feel like your Mizzium Mortars are going somewhere else.
Right,
yeah.
So, like, you know, it's that standard game plan of, like, you know, you side out your removal against the control deck, and the control deck brings in a couple creatures that are going to be, you know, punishing you for doing that.
Right, I mean, it's a rock-paper-scissors game of, if you expect them to be doing that, then you want to be keeping your mortars in for their, you know, Archangels or Brimaz or Blood Barons or whatever.
So again, we come back to domestication and the mono blue thing to next level.
Right, except no, domestication is like, it's like a Mizzium Mortars that if they play Last Breath on you, then their creature comes back to life.
Yeah.
Or if they play a Detention Sphere, your creature comes back.
Well, we saw like every way that you could get that creature back in that game.
Pretty much.
It was like as soon as you got it back, like the last time, and he just ripped the domestication off the top. Like, I was just dying because me and Lewis were standing behind the guy and we're just watching everything. And like when he sideboarded, I was just like, again, it blew me away that he took the Bidens out. Like the Bidens, I just feel like you want all the Bidens. Like that just,
yeah. And I actually think like Biden is actually not bad. One of your better cards, in fact, against the Angel Plan, because if you can resolve a Biden, you have a bunch of random dorks. Let's say. You force them to attack, and then at least you get to attack with your guys and draw three cards or something. It's like you'll draw Rapid Hybridization, and then maybe you can start pulling ahead.
Well, it's even to the point where it's like you may even reconsider attacking in the first place. Like even if he's only got one guy, you might just want to sit back and prevent him.
Right, but I mean, you can use the Biden to force.
Oh yeah, force the attack. Yeah, of course. Yeah. It has a second ability.
Just like KYT, I also played against Ben Sec and. He forced me to attack with his Biden, and it was good. But, like, I think that's probably what you have to do, even though it's not ideal. I don't think the domestication plan is very good.
No.
So Alex, your changes would be, like, you'd probably cut an Azorius Charm for a land, I guess. That's what you're saying.
Yeah, I think I would. I would probably have to put in some more testing to make sure that that's correct. But
And you also like Lucas's idea. Of because he and I playtested Blue White Saito before, and we had a little group, me, him, Alex, and John, and he suggested Far and Aways, and you said you could see that being a good replacement for Dark Betrayals, right?
Yeah, I mean I feel it serves a bit of a different purpose though than Dark Betrayal does. Like I think Far and Aways a lot better against say the green red monsters deck, and possibly you know a more varied metagame than. The one like higher rounds at the Grand Prix, where you know there's mostly just mono black, mono blue, blue white. I think if I'm playing against a mono black deck, I would rather have Dark Betrayal than Far and Away in my sideboard.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just because they play a Pack Rat with a Mutavault or some open. You know, what are you gonna do? Same with even like Desecration Demon, and Far and Away is a lot more mana. Like. If you watch my match against John Stern, for instance, like I pay one mana and Dark Betrayal is demon, and then cast Sphinx's Revelation the same turn.
Yeah.
And if I was Far and Away, I wouldn't be able to do that for as much value at all. So
it'd be like a really like super divination for like infinite mana. So, could you define what more testing is? Because it's my understanding that the first game you played with this deck was in round four.
Well, yeah, that is true. I mean, I have experience with blue-white decks before, but this particular build with my first round was in round four.
So, is that what day one of the GP is for you, playtesting?
No, I mean, I often get more playtesting, and I wasn't really, like, planning to go to GP Vancouver a while back. I've been purposely kind of avoiding standard tournaments and because I didn't really like the format and trying to go into more limited tournaments. I don't think I would have gone to Vancouver if I wasn't going to Sacramento. So, plus, if it wasn't a Canadian GP, like if it was in Seattle or something, I think I just wouldn't have gone.
So, yay Canada.
So, is this going to affect how many GPs you go to now? Basically, you know, the top five is a relevant issue, right, in terms of points and stuff? So how does that impact your choices moving forward?
So right now, my top five GP results are in two individual wins, a team win, which is worth only 6 points instead of eight.
Okay.
A top 16 and a top 32. So I also have a top 20 teams and a top 64, which are equivalent, which aren't counting because they're worse than my top five. Mm-hmm. So at this point, basically, I gained one pro point from a top 16 finish and like two from a top eight finish and four from a finals finish and six from a individual win. So it's a lot harder for me to gain points. On the other hand, like there's the fact that if I win another GP, then I'll have the record of most GPs won in a season.
If you guys know Alex at all, this is not something that he's ever possibly going to be able to avoid. If it's within his reach, he's probably going to like overextend just for the fame and notoriety that gets associated with that.
Well, it's just a pretty cool thing to be able to say, like, you know,
it's another dagger for you to throw at somebody. Let's be honest.
Well, I mean, you know, like right now, I'm sharing the record with, I believe, Yuya and Kaibude. So that's pretty cool, but you know, it's if I can get another win, then that would of course be awesome. And like, I'm gonna play a bunch of GPs. GPs are fun. I love meeting the people. I love, you know, I just love playing Magic, and I'm not gonna force myself to go to Grand Prix just to get points, but I'm gonna go to ones that I would like to go to, and if I get to beat the record, and that'd be awesome. But if not, then I don't, but I'm also right now missing 4 points for Platinum, so if I can even get a couple points from Grand Prix, that would probably help. Yep. So the three Pro Tours are really the things that I'm planning to be focusing on.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Now, so there's a wicked rumor that you guys are traveling overseas in a container, in a storage ship or something?
I can neither confirm nor deny said rumors.
Okay.
But by the way, is my internet connection okay?
Yeah, it's fine.
Yeah, all right. Just it could be. It's been a little shaky sometimes.
Yeah, satellite based internet.
Is this just a big old troll? Like, honestly, like in a shipping container? How is this real?
It isn't.
It can't be.
Whoa.
So what's the next GP you're going to win?
Well, my next tournament is actually the Pro Tour coming up in Valencia.
Yeah.
My team, we've decided that we're skipping the GP before in Paris. To focus on getting more testing.
Isn't that Legacy, too? Like, isn't that one of your baby formats?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I like Legacy a little less since True Name Nemesis entered the format. But
it'll get banned. It'll get banned on Monday.
We'll see. Anyways, I am skipping Paris, and so hopefully the Pro Tour goes well. But the week after the Pro Tour, there is a Team Grand Prix in Barcelona, where I'm going to be teaming with Josh McLean and John Stern. You might know John Stern. He lost in the top four of.
Shit! Dagger.
And yeah, I mean, they're both good friends of mine, and both excellent Magic players. And I look forward to guiding them through a Team Grand Prix.
Yeah.
In your semifinal match, how many times did John Stern rub his temple?
His temples of silence, or. But yeah, I mean, so that's exciting because it'll be the first Grand Prix I played since Vancouver, which I won. It'll be the next tournament after Pro Tour Barcelona in Barcelona, which I won. It'll be the next Team Grand Prix after GP Kyoto, which I also won. So hoping to win that one too. That'd be sweet.
Oh God, it just won't stop.
It'll just be like the case where it's like, I gotta play in a GP, I gotta play a solo GP, because like these 6 points from the team win are really just hampering my record. I need to get to eight.
Yeah, well, I mean, I joked with some friends that my ideal plan for my five GPs was to drop the team GP win. You know.
Yeah, that would be sick.
That would be pretty cool. I mean, you know, Frankie Richards, you know, he believes in me. He's like, Alex, are you going to be the first player to get the five GP wins in a season? And we got fours on the list first, you know. We're gonna see if we can get there.
But, yeah, hopefully you do. I mean, that's going to be like a pretty sweet Hall of Fame push much later down the road where, like, this guy had, like, the sickest GP season ever, so.
Yeah, I mean, that's sweet. I mean, that's definitely something, you know, that I think about for the future that I would love, you know, to be able to put up a career that's Hall of Fame worthy. And certainly if I could get there on my first ballot, that would be even more sweet. But I'm going to just do what I can do, you know, just going to play Magic, going to try and play my best. And if I win, I win. If I don't, I don't.
Mm. Yeah. Scott, I don't know if you know, like, how Alex describes playing, these team tournaments. Like,
no.
He sees himself as the puppet master, and like John Stern is his puppet.
Oh, God.
Pulling the strings, you know? Just pulling the strings.
You should address John as puppet the entire tournament.
I mean, the thing is, both Josh and John are just two nice guys to like say anything, you know? They're just going to quietly put up with my shit, you know?
This is true. This is fact.
Like, you know, like I'm not gonna say the puppet thing unless it's, you know, usually instead of in front of their faces.
Yeah.
And then KYT's there, he's gonna laugh, and they're both gonna be like, "Well, yeah, I guess."
Jesus.
But it makes it even funnier.
No. I mean, I like team tournaments. I definitely like helping my teammates, but I definitely cannot play three matches at once. Nor would I want to. The fun is sharing that experience with other people.
It's always an opportunity to learn something, right?
Yeah, I mean, definitely for my teammates. No. it always is. And like, I actually find I learn quite a bit during team tournaments. You know, like when I teamed with John Stern and Kaplan in Providence, It was quite a learning experience, and especially getting to see the contrast between the two of them. You know, for instance, we could just the story of once the match is over, let's say we've won, and I'm handed the slip as the person in the middle, and I sign the slip. And by the time I finish signing the slip, you can basically just see the back of Kaplan's foot as he's leaving the site to go smoke outside. You know, he's just, okay, boom, he's gone, like a bullet. And John slowly taking off his glasses, putting his elbows on the table, grabbing his hands, rubbing his temples and hands through his hair and going like, "Oh, I'm so old. Oh, I'm so freaking old. Oh, I'm too old for this shit."
So I heard a rumor that you actually like intentionally drew out that game one in round four to 40 minutes just so that John would like lose the edge.
I mean, he had the option to concede at any time, but no, I did not draw it out to 40 minutes on purpose, but I did get a sweet dagger into the coverage about, you know, John not being able to handle more games like that.
God.
But, I mean, that's the thing I teased John about, you know, him being old, and he's old and wise enough not to get involved in such arguments.
Ah, I see.
That game was awesome for the super sweet dissipate mana.
Oh, yeah. The shock on turn three. I mean, a lot of people notice that, but there's also important the follow-up of turn four playing a Mutavault, because the other lands in my hand are two islands.
Yeah.
So if I just play an island, then the story doesn't hold true. Like,
yeah.
You know, why did I shock myself if I had another island? Did I just draw that island? You know, what are the chances of that, right? It's pretty low. So, whereas I play the Mutavault, and it's like, okay, he needed to shock himself to have the second blue, which means also that I don't have syncopate, that I have dissolve.
Yeah.
So, just, you have to sell that story, and I don't know if I don't think I would do that play against, you know, a random opponent, but John's someone I respect enough to pick up on something like that, you know, and with my hand at the time being like detention spheres or something, supreme verdict, you know, I didn't really want him to play out a threat at that point.
Yeah.
So, yeah, just stuff like that. I mean, it was definitely an interesting match, and it went pretty long, but I think that was just the nature of how the match plays out often. He had all four connections relatively early, and so I kind of had to claw back out from a pretty big hole.
But it really shows the power of Sphinx's Revelation, because like that game was all John's, and then you resolve Sphinx's Revelation, and all of a sudden it just feels like John is now suddenly on the back foot.
Right. I mean, he's drawing two cards a turn, but you know, every few turns, I think as one of the commentators said, I draw seven cards, you know?
Yeah.
Also, my deck has answers to everything his deck can try and do, but the fact that he's mono-black restricts the answers that he actually has.
That's always been my toughest part against playing against control, because I always feel like you're never afraid of the cards that they've already cast. You're always afraid of the cards they could cast. Like, that's the thing, is I psych myself out when I play against control.
Right.
And yeah. It's very much KYT, like eating that oyster at that hot pot place, where it's like sometimes I just have to grin and bear it. You know, like it's just like I'm going to get Supreme Verdict either way. So let's run out a second threat, because I want to close this game out if he doesn't have it.
Well, that's why I think blue white is one of the hardest decks to play against, because you start thinking of like you said, all the different type of answers that they could have, and then you could definitely play a line that just falls right into their hands where they actually have the right answers. So then you start to second guess yourself and play badly. And that happened to me a lot at the beginning in my first PTQ. I thought I played terrible against blue white because I wasn't able to tell what answers they had or be able to play in a way that, you know, maximize my chances against, you know, the different type of cards that they had. So it's really easy to overthink, like, does he have Sphere here? Does he have Verdict? Do I just commit here because he doesn't have those things and all he has is, like, Sphinx Revelation, so I want to put as much pressure on him as possible. So there's a lot of that going in my mind when I play against blue-white.
Yeah, like, it was crazy to watch John pack rat out Huey in game one of, like, the round 15 match. Where it's just like he just runs out pack rats. It's like he just feels like Huey doesn't have it, and he just didn't.
I mean, that's often what you have to do. I think playing against the control like requires a lot of kind of skills that people have to learn in Magic to get better, which is like the skill really to play around what you can afford to play around and nothing more. Like, okay, if you play around just a little bit more than what you can actually afford to, it's going to cost you. And same vice versa, if you don't play around what you can't afford to, you know? You have to realize, like, what can I actually realistically beat this game? And if you're, you know, if they have a Supreme Verdict, you're not going to win no matter how you play it, then you might as well just play out all your creatures, right?
Yeah.
Whereas if you think you can't, you know, even if he has a Supreme Verdict, you think you can still win if you, you know, do this and this, then you should go for it. But, you know, what if by, like, playing around Supreme Verdict that you lose to, like, if he has Last Breath or Tension Sphere or Jace or something? In that case, it's much more likely that he has one of those cards than exactly Supreme Verdict, unless you have reason to believe otherwise. And so you should play in the other way, and so on. You always have to kind of, you know, when you're playing Control, it's kind of the opposite, where you have to think of, like, what card, how can you maximize the use of your cards to, like, against your opponent's threats, and what threats do you think you can beat, you know?
Yeah.
And I mean, one of the reasons I played Blue Eye Control was, you know, KYT told me I should play whatever deck that I can provoke my opponents into making the most mistakes with, because that's what I'm best at. And so I went with Blue Eye Control, and thank you, KYT, worked out pretty well.
Did you feel like during the GP that a lot of players were making mistakes against you?
Definitely. I mean, the most notable one being where you were next to me, and I was playing a blue-white control mirror, right? And right. So I felt pretty bad about this one, because first I sit down, and my opponent's like, oh, you know, you're Alex Hain, you know, I'm a big fan of yours, you know, after the match, can you sign my playmat? And he takes out his phone and says, I'm just texting my friends to let them know when they're done their matches to come here to watch me play. So then in game one, he resolves an Aetherling, because he's way ahead in the land drop war. You know, he's attacking me with it. And at one point, I Azorius Charm it, you know, to stave off lethal. And he blinks it, of course. And then he plays a Jace, minuses the Jace. You know, I split the pile. He takes the smaller pile and passes the turn. And my turn, I play a Scry land, I scry, and I played Tension Sphere. And at this point, When Pentangensphere hits the stack, he realizes he forgot to return his Aetherling at the end of the turn to its blink ability.
Yeah.
So here's how the new triggers work, is that it's been a full turn cycle. You're a judge, Jeremy, right? You know this?
Yeah.
So the Aetherling trigger is considered missed, so I have the choice of whether or not I want to put it onto the stack. So, you know, like, basically, I think some magic writer said this, that, you know, you either feel like a jerk if you don't let them have the trigger, or you feel like an idiot if you let them have it. Because basically at this point, I have the choice whether I want to win the game or lose the game. You know?
And, yeah.
I mean, I chose to win the game, but I felt pretty bad about it. And after the match, you know, I asked if he still wanted me to sign his playmat, you know.
Wow.
And I mean, he did, and he wanted to get pictures and stuff, so
yeah.
He was a good sport about it. He realized, you know, it was his own mistake, really, that, and it's an awkward spot to be in. That's the thing I hate the most about the trigger rules.
Yeah, I kind of felt like your feel bads from like my seat.
Yeah.
When I was playing.
Well, like, I mean, you know, he's like, oh, my Aetherling, and I'm like, oh, God, like, what do I do, you know? Like, I basically have this, you know, this tournament can potentially be on the line right here with this game, like, if I win or lose, and, you know, it's a dilemma.
No, I thought Aetherling was one of those triggers, though, where it actually has to come back. That's actually the one part that, like, to me, when, like, you started telling this story, I figured it just came back, but you got to make the choice. But I thought Aetherling was one of the, like, the triggers, like, much like if you forget the trigger for a Geist St. Traff, you don't get to keep the angel.
Right, well, I think that's apparently not how it was with the Judd. You know, it's like, it never comes back. In fact, it's not that it comes back the next turn or something.
Yeah, because normally with, like, a trigger like that where they would correct it, like, how they would do it is, you decide if the trigger resolves immediately, like if it goes on the stack immediately, or if it goes onto the stack at the beginning of the next step. So, like, that's how that would play out if it's one of those types of cards. And I thought that Aetherling was one of those types of cards where it's like, it can't just disappear. Like, it can, if it's missed, it comes back, but it comes back a little bit later. Like, it comes back when it's noticed.
Yeah, well, so, I mean, I'm not a judge myself, but
yeah.
You know, one of the things that actually decided my decision was I had Aetherling in my own deck, and in my previous round, my opponent, you know, after finally extending the hand, told me that, like, he was just playing for me to miss my Aetherling trigger earlier on, you know, and, like, I'd always been careful about announcing it all the time, and that, you know, so I felt like, what if the situation was reversed, you know, in another round, if I'd forgotten my Aetherling trigger, you know, there's no guarantee at all that anyone's gonna let me have my Aetherling in play, right? So, and I feel it's kind of only fair if there's, like, a same standard for everybody, right? Yeah. If I forget that, then I don't get my Aetherling, but if my opponent forgets that, they also don't get their Aetherling, rather than, like, if I forget that, I don't get my Aetherling, but if my opponent forgets, it's okay.
Yeah.
It's, I don't know, it's a little messy. There's a lot of things I like about the new trigger rules, but that's not one of them. There's definitely a bunch of feel-bad moments.
Well, that's the tough part, is that, like, the feel bads, though, have to happen. Like, that's how people learn. Like, the ultimate goal is that everyone plays tight magic and everyone plays proper magic. And, like, it's one of those awkward spots where it's, like, you just have to do that. And you got to kind of encourage that, because it starts to break down the stigma that calling a judge is a bad thing.
Exactly, and,
like,
yeah.
Yeah, like, that's just, you know, like, something that I've, you know, spoken out before on the show, that judges are all there to try and make sure everyone has a good time. So it sucks that those situations happen, but that's how we learn.
Right, and I was impressed with how well my opponent took it, you know?
Yeah.
He was very mature about it and realized, you know, it was his mistake. If he remembered his trigger, you know, wouldn't have ended up in that position. And, I mean, I think in the future he'll remember his triggers. So.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that the other mistakes besides that, there's a lot of them. I mean, Magic's a hard game, and there's a fair amount of decisions in the current standard. I mean, I don't really like the lack of diversity in the decks that you have choices of, but the games, the way they play out, unless you're in a Packrat mirror, which looks miserable, they seem pretty interesting. So I mean, I even saw Pack Rat Mirror turn out like play skill matters, where John Stern's playing a Pack Rat Mirror against his opponent, and John Stern's at one life, has an Underworld Connections on a swamp and a Pack Rat in play, and a Mutavault, and the opponent also has a Pack Rat and Mutavault. And there's no way, like, opponent can just keep drawing until they hit a Grey Merchant, and then at that point they're going to win, right? Because they're just keeps on attacking, making a Pack Rat. John has to block and then Mutavault to trade Pack Rats, and that the cycle just keeps going and going forever, right? Until eventually the opponent draws a Grey Merchant, John's dead. Because they're always just discarding the card they draw to make a Pack Rat.
Mm-hmm.
However, John at one point draws Devour Flesh, and like the only way John can win at this point is for his opponent to screw up. So he casts the Devour Flesh, and the opponent activates Mutavault and sacrifices it, and then like starts casting spells that he draws. Like he casts a Nightfell Spectre, you know, he plays a Mutavault that he draws, and like John starts pulling in, and he actually starts being attacking for damage with death with the rats, and like his opponent's dead in two turns, but then finally draws Grey Merchant to kill him. I was like, ah, oh. So. No justice.
Yeah.
But I mean, John ended up winning the match anyways, but that's just an example of, you know, like, often you have, when you're in a position like that, you have to make a play to provoke a mistake is the only way you can win. Like, is the death, doing the Devour Flesh is actually worse, you know? I would rather have a Pack Rat than a Mutavault in that scenario.
Yeah.
But there's always... no, I think even with Mono Black, there's definitely ample opportunities to provoke mistakes. But
well, yeah, KYT actually had a match against the guy who had the deck coverage with the Agents of Fate, and he kind of put his opponent into a spot where his opponent could have easily won it, but he sacrificed a rat. He did the exact same thing. Like, he acted very, he made a rat and then gave KYT the opportunity to kill off the one rat that he had when he had the massive mana advantage, he had the card advantage, he had the life advantage. So he had everything going for him. All he needed to do was untap with Pack Rat, and he pretty much would have won that match.
Yeah, yeah. I was at one with the connections, and he had two connections, and he was roughly at 15-14. Yeah. So I think he was, I don't know, focused on beating me up with Night Howlers and his other pet cards. But so I ended up punishing him for that mistake. But obviously I made my share of mistakes, like I stated in my article, not attacking with Erebos when I should. Yeah. So, right. You know, everyone makes mistakes, and
everybody did. I made plenty of mistakes that tournament. You know, everybody does make mistakes, and it's just trying to minimize your mistakes and minimize the cost as much as you can.
Yeah, and like as you mentioned, also the tilting aspect of it. Like, you know, a lot of people will refer to the Randy Buehler move, that clip where he's playing against a Dwarven Blast Miner, and he puts the dual land down, and the guy just blows up his land, and Randy Buehler it never even happened. Like, he just keeps playing. You know, it's just like one of like these like awesome examples of like a player who like just made like a really dumb mistake, but just lets it roll off his back and keeps playing the best magic that he can.
Right. I mean, you can't do anything about a mistake you've already made, right?
Yeah.
You know, and often, sometimes people, in fact, make another mistake to like make the previous mistake better or something, you know? And that's again wrong. You have to just, you know, shrug it off and say, okay, I'm going to, like, analyze how this game went after the match, but right now I'm still in the match, and I still have to do everything I can to win, you know, not get, like, angry at myself. Like, some players, when they notice they made a mistake, get visibly frustrated, you know, and then they start just completely tilting off and just making even worse plays, because they're like, oh, I already didn't play perfectly, what's the point anymore? Well, here's a little secret. You didn't play perfectly in the first place, even before that mistake.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I'm a big believer in kind of the in the way of thinking that like nobody's ever played a perfect game of Magic. That like blinking at the wrong time is a mistake, or not blinking at the correct time, and just everything you do matters. And there's just the better I've gotten in Magic, the more and more of my own mistakes I've noticed. Not that I like am making more mistakes. In fact, I'm making less. It's just the mistakes that I didn't notice I was making before, but I am now. And you have to not let it bother you. You know, we're all human. We're all going to make mistakes, and you just got to do your best and try and learn from your mistakes to do better next time.
Yeah.
You mentioned a judge thing. I had a story that I wrote in my article, and I know Jeremy likes the story. It's my friend Kenny playing in the X I believe the X3 or 2 bracket.
It was
something.
The X2 and 2 bracket.
X2 and 2 bracket. And he's playing like Esper control, and he's playing against like blue-white control, like in some sort of control mirror match. And I think from Kenny's, this is Kenny's story. I know I felt like he's been playing relatively slow compared to how he plays other decks. So I don't really blame this for happening. So apparently he thought seized the opponent. He tanked a bit, and then he sin collected, and he tanked a bit. And I guess maybe the judge thought he was still like tanking over the thought seize as he's turning around. So he tells Kenny, like, I've been hovering around your match for a while now, and I'm going to give you a warning for slow play. Now his opponent actually goes out of his way to say, for what it's worth, I don't think he's playing slow. And then the judge replies, well, I'm about to give you a warning for slow play. And I found out later that this guy is actually known for slow playing, according to some of his friends. So we got two guys that, you know, for me, were probably playing slow. So, but they decide to actually quicken their pace. They played a bunch of quick draw glows. They just went like land go, land go, land go. So after that, the judge is like, well, I need to go to another match. He's telling this to Kenny, but your performance has improved. I thank you, and the tournament thanks you.
The rest of the tournament thanks you, yes.
Yeah, that's the good line.
And then he's like, what the fuck? We're in the X, like, whatever bracket. And yeah, so, but I guess, like, the judge felt like he was holding up, like, all the important rounds.
Well, I mean, didn't he almost go 3-3-3?
Yeah.
You know, when you're already in the double draw bracket, I think being accused of slow play is probably a reasonable thing.
Right,
you know,
right.
Like, okay, you have one draw, all right, you know, maybe one match went really long, but you have two draws, you know, two draws, like, no, and nobody conceded one of the other matches, right, which means, like, maybe you only got to play two games, like.
Well, it's like, I think if you get lucky nine, like, you should be able to day two. They should just day two you if you lucky nine.
Lucky nine.
Well, I mean, John Stern, you know, he's known as a deliberate player, and there's a story from back in the day when he was playing Blue-Green Madness. No, not a super slow deck. Blue-Green Madness.
Yeah.
Where he went undefeated on day one of a Grand Prix, but did not make day two. Because he went 4-0-4.
Oh, God.
Wow.
I believe he played against, like, Oath of Druids two or three times or something. And just, like, neither player would play anything because John couldn't play a creature because then they just Oath. And then this was just, like, draw, go, like, discard. You know? I was reminded of a funny story from the tournament where I'm playing against a black-white opponent who, you know, turn one, thought seizes me, sees my hand, takes a card. And turn two, you know, I draw my card for the turn, play a land pass. Turn two, he plays Duress and says, like, I'll take your Dark Betrayal or something, right? So he sees my hand, and the card I drew, of course, was Jace. So I'm just like, put the Dark Betrayal in my graveyard, you know? And then, I mean, luckily for him, he had another Duress or whatever, so he Duresses, takes a Jace. And then, so I draw for my turn, Sphinx's Revelation, pass the turn. He plays Sin Collector and says, I'll take your Supreme Verdict or whatever. Should I show my hand? Get rid of my Supreme Verdict, you know? And he ends up losing to the Sphinx's Revelation. So guys, as smart as you feel, like, knowing what you're going to take from your previous discard spells, remembering my hand or somebody else's hand, you should probably look at what the new information is. Because some people are really lucky and they draw sweet spells every turn.
Yeah. And just also, like, to put it out there from, like, the judge side of things, if you're in a position where you can make a decision and you make a decision before you're given all the information, you have to stick to that decision. So, like, if you say Duress, I'm going to take your Dark Patrol, and they flip over and they show you a Sphinx's Rev, you can't say, oh, actually, I want the Sphinx's Rev. Like, if you lock it in before you see and it's a legal target, you take that. That's a shortcutting rule.
Right. Like, if you play Slaughter Games as well and you name, let's say, Sphinx's Revelation, you can't. And then they're like, okay, it resolves, let's say. I mean, obviously Slaughter Games resolves, but they're the same Remora side. Then you can't change your mind afterwards after finding out that it resolves, you know? Because you've already stated it, though you don't actually have to state it before the spell resolves.
Yeah, you name the spell after resolution or during resolution.
Right. But if you do name it before, you actually have to, you can't use it to like mind game someone like a friend of KYT and mine, Toby Rosman, would probably try.
So we do have one question, which I think the whole world is just dying to know. Carl wants to know, obviously you sold your soul to the devil.
Oh.
He's actually just curious as to the rate that you got. I mean, a PT and three Grand Prix, are we looking at top-ending pricing there, or is that just the first part of the payment?
So actually, in an earlier agreement, I actually won Jake Mazaris' soul from an agreement over who would do better at a certain Grand Prix. So I actually sold his soul to the devil.
Oh. No.
In fact, at one point, Scott, you were expressing interest in purchasing it, but I'm just like, yeah, you know, Jake Mazaris' soul, and you know, I got offered a lot more for my soul, but you know, the value of Jake's was a little lower, so it's only like a few GP wins, you know, and some of that other stuff.
Nice.
So that was just hard work to get the rest of the ones done. So or Jake, you have to win someone else's soul.
Yeah, I mean, Jeremy, are you into betting?
Just take BZ's. You take all of his money. So
no, he's wisened up. He's wisened up.
He's wisened up.
Yeah, he doesn't play backgammon or in any games of skill with me anymore.
No more dice.
Dice. I think he can play, but those are not games of skill.
When you have the fixed dice, it is a game of skill.
Well, I mean, you just need to know how to choose even or odd correctly.
Yeah. So Norbert wants to know, this is for both you and KYT, will there ever be a Crazy Talk reunion?
No.
I mean, I don't think that's up to us. I think that's up to God to decide.
Oh, wow. Such a quick wit. All you the
best. You'd best start praying, Norby. Sorry, buddy.
Scott, my favorite question, it's not a serious question, it's actually the one before that. It's just so stupid.
Oh, sure, okay. So the Duggernaut wants to know, why are the numbers on my phone laid out as 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, but the numbers on my keyboard are 7, 8, 9, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3?
I think the answer is that you look at your keyboard while sober, but your phone is often when you're out drinking, so you're a little disoriented.
Okay.
Okay, we'll go with that one.
Okay. Jesse wants to know, of course, A-Team Emeritus Jesse Smitty Smith wants to know, how often does being an all-star of Magic get you laid?
Well, I mean, it's hard to separate that from just my natural good looks and charm.
Yeah.
I would say it's gotten me a couple more opportunities than I would have had otherwise.
That's fair. That's a good answer. Mikey Dubs wants to know when you're getting a haircut.
Well, I actually recently got a haircut. Whether it's a good haircut or not is the question.
Okay.
I mean, I generally, you know, every 8 to 12 months or something.
Okay. Okay.
I don't know. I actually like usually keeping my hair longer in the winter, but I was visiting some warmer places and being traveling all the time, it's nice to keep it short.
Yeah.
Maybe you should get it cut overseas so you can try that out. You know, like maybe not I a lot of people can say, yeah, that I got my hair cut overseas.
That's true. I mean, I could just ask who KYT's barber is, you know, because he always has such a magnificent head of hair. So magnificent that he decided the GP to cover it with a Man in Private like hoodie, you know, or actually toque rather.
I was watching the Twitch chat when you were playing against John, and the main discussion point while you guys were taking like the epic bathroom breaks after the first marathon game was Jeff Foster's hair. So maybe you should go down to wherever he gets his haircut. That could be anywhere on the continent, knowing Jeff's travel schedule. But
or nowhere. It could be nowhere, right?
Yeah, it could be nowhere. It could actually be nowhere.
Probably the more likely.
Well, Alex, also, because it was on the topic of like, That part of the match and Twitch, because we both know that John is deliberate, and he was at the end of that game, like he dragged it on for at least a good 10 minutes when he was clearly going to lose that game, and like the whole Twitch chat is like,
oh, just
fucking concede already. Fucking scoop the fucking cards.
You check the written coverage. In fact, he says that if that was in a real tournament, he would have conceded like 40 minutes ago. Because of the Swiss. And then for that one, I got a nice dagger in on him. You know, that I hope that we have another game like that because John's too old to handle it.
At a certain point, I did think that he was going to win that game at a certain point because I guess he, for me, I felt like he just couldn't draw a gray merchant for his life when he was getting connections. And it's like he was just attacking you with two mutavals, getting you down to like two life almost in the 2-6 zone. And just a merchant or two from his connections was going to get him there.
Right. Like, I mean, there was the point until Sphinx Revelation that at that point, like, I think a gray merchant would have killed me. Mm-hmm. But after that, like, I was sitting on last breath the whole time so that I was always ready in case he did have the gray merchant that I would last breath it with the trigger on the stack, bringing me to two life exactly, actually. And then he wouldn't be able to return it with whip because it would be exiled.
The Twitch chat was definitely funny. Just fucking concede already, John.
Well, you know, I mean, in game two, for instance, where I used minus ability from Jace, and the three cards are Sphinx's Revelation, and Dissolve. All right? And the commentator's like, how do you divide this? You know, do you go give him Sphinx's Revelation and Dissolve, or do you give him, like, two Sphinx's Revelations or Dissolve? And John ended up, that's what he ended up doing in the match. He gave me two Revelations or Dissolve. But afterwards, we actually figured out what the correct split was. And the correct split was to offer your hand and concede the match.
Considering
John and I had already going in at a 25% split going on, and for me to not waste my mental energy going to the finals was in his best interest as well.
Yes. Oh, God.
John just won't give up. Any more questions, Scott?
In the Facebook page? Actually, we have a question for you.
Oh.
No. Actually, it is a question for Alex.
I like the Eric Trombley one, if that's the one you're looking at.
No, I got another one. Okay. Alex, Joe wants to know if the pros can feel the heat of KYT nipping at the heels of the Pro Tour.
Whoa, we're...
I mean, KYT is kind of like a dog in heat.
Oh, God.
No, but I mean, I don't know, nipping of the heels? I would say KYT is, you know, one of the better players in Canada who's not yet qualified for a Pro Tour in his life. And he does keeps doing well, and, like, he's got a good attitude, but...
No,
he's got a long way to go, you know, to hang with the big...
So you said he's one of the best. Is there somebody that you would say that is better than him that hasn't qualified for the tour yet?
Nobody that I really know, but again, like, I don't really play the PTQ circuit anymore, so I don't really get to know a lot of people, and I don't really know many of the people, let's say, from let's say out west, right? There could be a lot of players KYT's level or above who I just don't know. So I'd say of the players who I do know, I think I would probably rank KYT as the best one in terms of both, you know, talent plus work and experience.
Attitude.
Mental inclination.
Positive attitude.
I've never been on the in the Pro Tour.
Yeah, we had a discussion for Alberta trying to figure out who is the best player in Alberta who hasn't qualified before. And I think that the three or four people I was talking with, we settled on Eric Chan.
Yeah, I know Eric Chan.
Yeah, so he's really good and hasn't qualified. So that's where we settled. We had a couple names.
What about GP Top 64 Brian Zemba?
Brian Zemba was, I think, number two on that list.
I mean, he might be the player who's not qualified for the Pro Tour in Canada with the most pro points.
That's very true. Yeah, that's very fair.
I mean, like, how many Top 64s does he have? You know, like 22 or something. Like, that's 22 pro points.
And I don't know if it was, I think it was Curly was our third pick.
No, he does not have 22. But...
I think he has 8 or something, he was telling me.
He cashed 5 in a row or something, which is pretty impressive to me.
Yeah. Like, that was during, like, Salt Lake City and stuff like that.
Was that a little bit of a humble brag, KYT? Aren't you at, like, 8 in a row now?
No, I didn't cash 8 in a row. So, but I did notice a coincidence, though. I don't know if it's actually truly home field advantage or if it's just pure coincidence, but out of my 8 GP day twos, if you don't count the team GP, which I cashed with Providence, the only GPs I've cashed are Quebec City, Toronto, and Vancouver.
Ooh.
Canadian only, meaning I scrub out on U.S. soil. And I, although I don't travel like as much as like a regular PT grinder, I have played PTQs outside of Canada, but my 7 PTQ top 8s are also all in Canada, which is a weird coincidence. Or, like, I just play better when I have more friends around me or something.
So. I mean, it might also be that, like, people in Canada are intimidated by you because they have, you know, you put you on a pedestal. They don't actually know that you're just some random scrub. You're like, he owns a pro website, you know? Like,
yeah, like, that's his line. Like, that's his game. Like, he sits down like, oh, wow, are you on the Man of the Private team? And he's like, no. Oh, well, are you a fan?
I am.
I own the website. And it's just like, bam, like just drops out of the table. And like the guy's just like, what do I do with this? Like he owns the fucking website.
It's like snap concede, you know? Just
exactly.
Snap. Where it goes to the US and they're like, who the fuck are you? And he's like, I own a website. Like, I don't give a shit. Like, stomps him, you know?
Well, I usually follow up with like, I'm not very good. I just run the site a bit. So
yeah. So then he sharks the person.
But
and they're like, man, this guy just sucks. And then you're like, you know, play like about average. And he's like, whoa, he's playing average.
What do I do? I was telling Scott, it was kind of weird. It was kind of weird in Toronto where like I'm sitting next to, I'm playing a match and Sammy T's next to me. And Sammy T's clearly probably the best player in that tournament, or at least the top two. You can argue with Lucas Yao or Glenn,
sure,
whoever. And then, like, my opponent, like, tells Sammy T that he's playing against a legend. So, like, it's gotten to that point where I don't know, like, what people actually think of me, like, how they've heard about my name and, like, but, you know, I have yet to make the Pro Tour, guys. So, I mean, but it was definitely a good feeling to be called legend. But I'm, like, I'm being called the legend next to the guy who's probably the best player in this tournament. By a reasonable margin, at least. Outside of Lucas and Glenn. So, and I'm Cappy, obviously, forgetting him. But like, I'm the one here, close.
Or can I say something?
Sorry?
Do you have any more people you have to give a shout out to? Or can I say something about, you know, like, for instance, I've actually never top 8 in the tournament in the US. How about that one?
Ooh.
I've at this point now I have 5 Grand Prix top 8s, 0 of them in the US, and my Pro Tour top 8 as well, it's not in the US. So, I have 3 of my top 8s are in fact in Canada, from Montreal, and my 2 wins now, Calgary and Vancouver. So,
first and second.
Yeah, I lost to Rich Owen there, which I still believe to be a strong strategic move.
Okay.
I mean, if you think about it, would you rather have a GP win or a GP finals and then later a GP win with the guy you lost to in the finals on your team?
Right.
See, that type of forward strategic planning is how you get to be a PT champion.
Was it that GP that you felt you earned his respect, or was it before that when you played him in the PT?
I think it was really at the GP that the PTQ is like, I was just like some random scrub. He was, you know, trying to troll me and stuff, put me off my game. I think the GP is when he began to respect me. And then at Worlds in San Francisco, he actually brought me out to dinner with like a bunch of people who I was really intimidated with at the time, which included actually Ben Sec, but also like Nassif, Paul Rietzel, and like Yelger. And, I was just like, whoa, and the interest me to them is the future of Canadian Magic.
Wow.
That was definitely quite something for me at the time, you know, I was just like, I just had a GP Finals, and Rich, who's like, you know, the past of Canadian Magic, was introducing me to the future of Canadian Magic to all these guys. And while, you know, a lot of people like KYT has always been spouting that as a big supporter, you know, it meant a lot coming from someone as respected as Rich.
I'm just like, blah, 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 blah. And guys like Willie G, my prez, are like, no, who is this guy? I'm like, trust me, man. Trust me.
Yeah, shout out to Willie G. My Prez. You know, we need the haters, you know.
We need the haters.
No, thank you, Willie G. This GP win was not possible with haters, without haters like you.
So Hayne had KYT, who is, you know, like pushing out his brand, and John Stern got Eugene. How did that work out?
I mean, you know.
True. Eugene. Wow. Wow. You got the better Asian. Oh.
I mean, yeah, but I hear Eugene puts out.
Oh, right.
Yeah, I was,
We're still waiting for the that sexual tension to finally come to a resolution, but it's not gonna happen. It's worse than The Mentalist. I was telling Alex for people watch that show.
God, The Mentalist is terrible for that.
Just have sex already. Fuck.
Yes, please.
But yeah, see, that's
the actual MacBook or something.
It's actually worse than that though, between Eugene and John. Like, you know, just like Eugene's like John Stern. You know, like, can you draw on your own, John Stern? Wanna go to the library and study, John Stern? See, I'm putting magic, John Stern didn't win, you know, like.
So there's one question on the Facebook I wanted to ask. What's by Eric Tremblay, what's better, winning all the Canadian GPs or owning Finkel with miracles?
Ooh.
Ooh, that's a good one. Says.
I mean, I was talking about this to my friend Josh McLean. It's like, you know, the first win is definitely sweeter than like the fourth win. You know, there's a diminishing return, and like it was my really first time in the spotlight, and I was so super nervous, and like it was a pro tour too. You know, and I'm against the player is considered best of all time by many. You know, John Finkel. I managed to beat him, and like I don't think that's an experience I'll ever feel the same way about in, you know, ever, even if I win like 10 more GPs.
Yeah, so. But for me, like how you won, like how it was game 5 for each of the set of matches yeah. Was like what?
I mean, it'd probably be the last time it'll be like that now that they're changing it to best 2 out of 3.
Yeah.
But, do you like that change? You know, because you're one of the people who actually it affects.
I don't think any of the pros really like the change. I think John Stern actually likes it because you prepare, you know, he says you prepare your deck for the tournament, which in the tournament's best 2 out of 3. So like for instance, a deck like Affinity, you know, is much worse in a best out of 5 top 8, where you have 4 sideboard games potentially than it is in the normal rounds. And that you plan to make it to the top 8 rather than to necessarily win.
That's a good argument.
But, I mean, I definitely like, you know, if we could play best out of 35 or whatever, I would prefer that, you know? The more you can minimize variance, the better. But I definitely can get behind John's argument that, you know, you want something consistent throughout the tournament and the top 8, you want to have the same incentives.
Right. Yeah, I could totally see it.
If it's better for coverage, then I think, you know, coverage is very important for growing the game and making it better for everybody.
Was anyone else expecting, like, Hayne to kind of go into that diatribe of John Stern liking the change and then make fun of him not being able to play long Magic because he's old? Like, that's... I really was...
I
like,
was literally waiting for it. Yeah, I'm sitting here like, is it coming?
Yeah, I 100%, like, I would have went all in on that.
You know, there's a limit. You know, John's my good buddy, but you know, there's a limit to how much I can push him. Like, no, he's too kind and like mild mannered that he might secretly be like a serial killer. You know? Like,
you know what? The amount that guy does in preparation and stuff like that, he would be a fantastic serial killer.
Oh, like, it's, you know, what do you mean? Would like he very much could be a serial killer?
That's how good he is.
Exactly, he would hide all his tracks perfectly. He would plan it all out. You know, he thinks like backwards, you know, like, okay, this is how I'm going to clean up the mess. And then I'm going to find my victim by how I'm going to clean up the mess, you know, like,
he's probably got like 5 pages, on, like what happens when he gets caught. And he probably knows like all the hobbies and interests of all the local detectives, because, you know, he does like that metagame hunt. Like,
Yeah, I mean, and he travels all over the world, you know, so he gets to...
Yeah.
He gets plenty of opportunities. Anyways, I think maybe we should switch off this tangent to knock us all off.
Yeah, exactly. I was telling Alex recently that he's just the most... it's just really impressive because he used to be a top player a long time ago. Then when he restarted, you know, a lot of people, when he restarted again, didn't feel like he was a top caliber player yet, like that he had to really get back on his feet a lot. And just to see like him evolve back into, well, I wasn't there when he was at his past prime, but to see him now at his current prime, and maybe he's exceeded the player he was 30 years ago, it's really impressive. It's really like with hard work and gradually getting there. I mean, I think Alex is just one of the more talented players, probably the most actually. And just to see John just slowly get there and grinding it and finishing top eighting Moto PTQs, multiple of them, and in real life, like finishing second in a bunch before getting there. And now to the Canadian public, to people like to the casual players who are just following the top 25, he's the second best player in the country. Yeah. Right. So that's insane. And
yeah, I mean, I have a lot of respect for John. And as you said, in one of your articles, right, QIT, you compared him to Peyton Manning.
Right.
Yeah, so like he just puts in the work and he's dedicated and he's serious, and it's also just awesome to work like with someone like that, you know. Especially it provides a lot of contrast to my like very much laissez-faire attitude.
It's like I wonder how the Pro Tour testing. Here's my super like detailed cyborg guide, and Alex just like is like, yeah, whatever.
My first introduction of John Stern was at the airport in Seattle, where he gave me my Manatee hoodie. And then somebody described him to me as, he's the guy testing with Alex because he has the house. So it was like, oh, okay. And like they're like, yeah, he's not very good. And so I kind of started off with him like mentally in the head, like, okay, so he's like, you know, kind of the come along. And then he did well at that PT. Like he didn't do super well, but he was like in the cash. He was in the tournament the whole time. And, you know, since then, he's just like been like just finishing better. So,
well, I don't know if I would agree with in the cash, because that's not actually true. But
no, he didn't cash that tournament.
No, he did not. He didn't. I don't think he even got an extra pro point.
I thought he had finished top 100. Like,
no, he didn't. But I mean, in fact, interesting thing is that a lot of people who tested that PT like were not impressed with John. But I think it's very much like, after that experience, he kind of really started to grow a lot as a player. Like, it's the team testing experience is a hugely beneficial thing to getting better. And I don't think it's a coincidence that he started his huge string of finishes like after that. You know, I would like to think that some exposure to me helped him. he definitely not with his methodology, but it helped him. I think, you know, with some things. And I definitely learned a lot from being on teams as well, and I've learned. I think a lot of the reason I've been doing very well lately is because I've been playing with him a lot. So it's it's mutually beneficial.
So, professional Magic player, where does that go? Like, what is the game plan for Hain over the next few years? Like, are you going to keep playing? Do you have aspirations to go out and stop playing and get the job and do all that kind of stuff? Like, do you have ideas for Magic that are outside of like what's already in the world? Like, I don't know.
Well, I mean, the get the job thing, you know, I don't know if you guys maybe only know a little bit about me, but you know, John Stern's definitely the get the job guy. I'm more the like, you know, guy.
I think it was said over the table last night. If Alex could go through life and find a way to not work, then he would actually be happier.
Yeah, I mean, I can partly agree with that, I guess. But coincidentally, Scotty was in fact in Montreal, and we had a good evening last night, a bunch of us.
Alex, unfortunately, was able to even up our lifetime cube record at one match each. unfortunately. I got fucking wrecked last night at Cube. Just wrecked. It was like not even fair. I don't know. I just got completely owned. I just drafted a really bad red-white deck. And I mean, the deck was probably fine, but all the other decks were fucking so much better than mine. And I just got like completely demolished. So it was good. It's a good time.
All right. So off of that tangent, Jeremy's question. I actually am planning to go back to school in September, and have a lot of the paperwork in front of me right now. In fact,
whoa,
yeah,
when
I know.
When you grow up,
I don't plan to ever grow up. You know, I definitely suffer from Peter Pan syndrome, but I don't know. I don't know what I want to do. That's always kind of been the problem with that. I can't really see myself like doing anything long term. Certainly can't see myself like sitting, you know, in an office building 9 to 5. But I have no idea what I really want to study. I think I'm just gonna basically take courses that interest me and just what I do enjoy doing is learning. So something I like take from Magic, and I try and learn as much as possible. And what this means for my Magic playing is I'll probably still make it to all the Pro Tours and stuff, but won't see me at as many GPs. So that's why it'd be particularly sweet if I can, you know, break the record this season.
Cool. Awesome. Well, the last question that's on everyone's list is, what are you playing in Modern for the Pro Tour?
You know, if I told you, John Stern would have to go and assassinate you or two.
It's true. I don't want that at all.
Imagine you haven't started testing at all because of the potential bannings.
I mean, if it was up to me, that probably would be the case. But John Stern, you know, is insistent on getting some foundation down there. And so we've been just getting like practice with the existing decks against each other and kind of learning the foundation of the format. If things change, then we'll figure out. You know, we haven't started brewing yet, though I think some members of the team have. And there's a lot of interesting stuff that can happen. I don't think the next set changes too much.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, I definitely cannot say what we're planning to do. But I can say I'm looking forward to the Pro Tour. I think we have a sweet team, and you know, I'm hoping to win back-to-back Pro Tours in Spain. That would be sweet, too.
Nice. Can you speak to some of the new members on the team and kind of like give a little bit of the background or the decision-making process of how you kind of came to your team?
We've been trying to streamline the team a bit. So the original vision for the team was we invited every Canadian Magic player who was qualified for the Pro Tour to play. And there were a lot of problems with that. Partly our team was too big, and partly there was just the gap between player levels was also too big, so that often testing results would be invalid. Let's say, you know, it's like, you have a player, let's say, if KYT playing against you, Jeremy, you know, and like, you know, it doesn't matter what the matchup is, you know, one of you is going to win more than the other. I purposely did not.
That is such a daggery thing to do.
But anyways, so we decided that it was more important to try and focus on getting a group of Canadian players on the pro circuit rather than just supporting every Canadian, and to kind of build from there. Like we want to have a regular base of qualified Canadian players going to Pro Tours. And so right now there's only John Stern and myself who are on the train. So we prioritize taking people who are close to getting on the train, as well as people who have a lot of promise, and kind of fill out the roster with, we've been filling with a lot of international players who, you know, we can count on having for more than one Pro Tour at a time, so that we have like a consistency and we know, you know, what to expect from people. So also for this Pro Tour, we've recruited some people who are particularly Modern experts. Like, for instance, we'll be working with Alex Magelton, who's known for his love of Affinity, and he's got, you know, like 5 GP top 8s with the deck. So, you know, I think we'll probably have the best list of Affinity, and in our testing, you know, we'll have a top, like, possibly the best player playing Affinity against us, so we'll know if our deck really does beat Affinity.
Yeah.
And you know, we have Josh McLean and Sam Pardee, who are both known as Malira Pod experts.
Yeah.
And
which you're no slouch at yourself.
I mean, I'm all right, but I wouldn't put myself anywhere near as good at the deck as those two. Like, I think Sam Pardee in particular is, you know, he's truly a master with the deck and just constantly plays it online and has tweaked it to really be what it is today.
Yeah.
And then, you know, we have John, who's also some affinity expertise, but top 8 at GP Toronto with Jund, you know, and we've got Ben Moore, who also is a GP top 8 with Jund, and is kind of one of the Canadian players we're trying to push forward.
That's good.
And we've gotten Glenn for which is unusual. We don't normally take people who it is their first pro tour, but Glenn McElwain has worked a lot with Kaplan, and you know we kind of know him, and I'm hoping good things for him. We have Steve Wolfman, who won the giant Toronto PTQ, I believe. And he's an old school player, actually, who has 2 Pro Tour top 8s. He's kind of, I guess, hoping to make a triumphant return. And we have Brian Bronduin and Todd Anderson from Star City.
That's cool.
Yeah, and I mean, I think we've often been recruiting people who we've, like, lost against in Grand Prix top 8, so we worked with Rich Hohen before and Jacob Wilson, and got Sam Pardee, who John lost to before, and now we have BBD, who he lost to in the finals of Louisville, and you know Todd came along, and you know we're working again with Dave Shields as well. I have a lot of respect for, and I think it's just, you know, all together we have an awesome team.
Nice.
Awesome. Seeing how like some of these guys, like, they all seem to be like grouped up geographically, was that like planned, or is that just like something that happened?
I mean, it's definitely another factor, because you know, while we do meet up ahead of time, like a week before the pro tour, it's good to get some testing before then, and we don't really want to be spreading too much information around, so if you have someone in your area you can test with, it works out perfectly, right? Lucas Siao, by the way, is the other modern expert who we also are going to be working with. I also respect Lucas a lot when it comes to Constructed. You know, he's very good at tuning, like, the best deck.
That's a first one for you, right? Like, Lucas has never really worked with you guys before.
No, we worked with him in Seattle, actually.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, yeah, I mean, you know, Lucas is fairly busy, so it's often hard for him to get the time off for the week of testing that we require. And I'm glad to be working with him again.
Nice.
I mean, the people we'd like to also be working with are Pascal and Kaplan, but unfortunately both of them are not qualified this time.
Yeah. Yeah, that's too bad.
But that's how it goes. It's tough. I mean, John Stearns made it look easy, you know, to get on the train this past year. It's not. It's a tough thing to do.
It's a difficult game.
Yeah.
All right. Well, if there's nothing else, guys.
Hayne, what do you want to talk about?
Yeah, anything?
I don't know. So what's it like being on the A team? Is it just cool? You know, is it just as, like, you know, picture perfect as the fans think it is?
Yep.
Yeah, basically. That's it. One other thing, I don't know, when we get to shoutouts, I guess I'll save that one.
Shoutouts. We don't do shoutouts anymore.
No, we're at shoutouts.
We're at shoutouts. Go. Yeah.
All right. So I've a few shoutouts, I guess, to Joshua Lemish.
Oh, he got married.
Yeah, he got married this weekend in Vancouver, and he wanted me to give him a shoutout at the GP, but I, you know, there wasn't really a good opportunity for that, and I felt it set a bad precedent. But I'll give him a shoutout now.
Nice.
And also, of course, Luis Acosta for the granola bars. Thank you once again.
You just made his day. Guy. Now you're like encouraging him even further.
I mean, if he keeps giving me granola bars and I keep winning Grand Prix, I'm okay with encouraging him.
It's sure. Not that funny, Luis. It's not that funny.
I don't know. I got two granola bars. They were sweet.
I also hooked Scotty and KYT into eating some terrible food. So
God, did you ever.
Judge, you know, just for you, Luis.
It was brutal.
Try to make sure that you don't lose that box to Scotty.
Well, he's already done.
Oh, yeah?
Oh, God, yeah. Like, give me Wednesday, it's over.
them's fighting words.
Them's fighting words.
And shout out to John Stern. You know, good job, buddy. Top four of GP, you know, pretty good.
Daggers never cease.
So good. Because John's the type that can take it. That's what's so good. So good.
That's true.
Yeah. You know, like, if you can't dagger your buddies, who can you dagger?
Yeah.
Over under on John listening to this.
Yeah, it's happening.
He actually listens to a lot more episodes than I thought he did. So really? I'm pretty sure he does. Yeah.
He's like, John really likes listening to stuff because it helps put him to sleep. Well, I mean, no, it's not necessarily because you guys are boring, but it's just because he's so old that, like, he actually needs the help to fall asleep. You know, he needs to be like lullabied into sleep.
Well, he's mentioned.
he's just too scared that if he falls asleep normally, that, like, it'll be the last time. You know.
He's mentioned to me a few episodes that he's listened to that, like, I didn't expect him to listen to. So he's one of our more. He's one of our more active listeners.
Yeah, he kind of listens in the same way that KYT talks, you know? Like,
oh, yeah. Silently.
Shout out to Jay Bush.
Shout out to Jay Bush for not being here.
Well, I'm sure he's off enjoying himself.
Yep. Yeah, I saw him on the way out on Wednesday, he and Beans and the in-laws, so they're all doing fine.
Beautiful.
Yeah, so that's sweet.
And yeah, shout out to Kenji and Soulbush One for first of all waiting for us, but also especially to Soulbush One for carrying KYT to a fifth place GP finish. And yeah, I got to team with him. In fact, at a team SCG, and we also came in fifth. So you know, don't worry. One time you'll get there, Soulbush One.
So it's interesting because there's other stuff to talk about. We got us some stuff sorted out while I was in Montreal. Ooh. And we've actually confirmed the venue 100%.
Sweet.
Which is fucking awesome. So the GP party is on. It's going to be at the Plateau Lounge, which is like super swanky and amazing, but the drinks aren't $1 million, so that's wicked. And, yeah, overall, guys, it's going to be an amazing, amazing weekend. So if you guys aren't getting ready to join us at GP Montreal yet for KYT and Phil Sam's birthday, then you guys are doing it fucking wrong. So fix your shit and get on board.
Yeah, I mean, I've been to GPs where Scotty was organizing various parties, and every time it definitely negatively impacted my GP performance.
This is absolute truth.
And after my stories of this last GP of the conditions I was in, you know, it takes a fair amount to negatively impact me. But you know, there a GP Toronto, Pascal woke up in a pile of his own puke and didn't notice.
Yeah,
that's how much fun he had the previous night. Right, let's just go with that.
Gotta take some of these clips and put them down as quotes if we make like an ad for this. Like, if there's like a page saying like what all the parties are gonna be, we gotta have like the hang quote. Like, this definitely negatively impacted my GP performance. Like, those are some beauty quotes.
Truth.
I mean, in Calgary, you know, I knew when it was time to call it quits, but in Toronto, I did not. So.
Yeah, Calgary, I didn't.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's going to be a good time. I'm pretty excited.
If you want to see KYT get beer poured on his head, you should come.
That's true, too.
I'm just thinking of a good ad campaign for, like, GP Montreal. See KYT get beer poured on his head.
Well, Maddie told anybody that if they were on the GP train, that they would get to touch my junk. So
what?
Yeah, I was kind of surprised by that. Like, that was kind of his angle. I don't know if that campaign's going to work out well for him, but...
So, okay, how about we raise the stakes? to at least get Eugene onto the train. Oh, you can patch John Stern's junk, you know, like you know, the junk of a GP top four, you know.
Oh, there you go. Exactly. I got a GP top two.
It's true. But that's the previous but GP Vancouver.
That's a finalist, you know. You're a finalist.
I got a plaque.
Oh, yeah, now they give trophies. And fun story, if you actually look at the GP Vancouver trophy pick where I'm holding out the trophy, or if you look at the coverage, you will never see the winner's trophy. I'm also holding out the finalist trophy. That's why it's all silver. Do you know why? Because in shipping, a certain trophy was damaged. So I have to wait a few weeks until I get my trophy in the mail.
Huh.
Do you think you'll get your trophy before you get your money?
I don't know. I hope the tournament organizer was joking when he said like 4 to 5 years before I get my trophy. I mean, if he was, then I'll probably get it, you know, a little bit after I get the money. If not, I'll probably get it around the same time.
Yeah, 4 to 5 years.
Those checks do take a little while to arrive at times.
Hasbro just, you know, they got to wait till payday.
For the checks to clear. Oh, man. All right, guys. Well, listen, it's time for us to pack it in for the night. Thank you very much for joining us here on the A-Team. Alex, super awesome to have you, dude.
Oh, my pleasure, guys. Anytime.
You need to come on my stream and play some modern once you guys figure out what's going on with the Pro Tour and shit. So
All right. That
too. Come on back. But yeah, in the meantime, good luck at the PT. Hopefully, all the testing goes well for you guys and for all of you out there listening. Come on back next week. Jay's still not back, but we're gonna fill the hole with someone. Hopefully nearly as awesome as Alex Hain.
Good luck.
Thanks.
Come back next week for Kai Buddy.
Also known as the German Alex Hain. No.
The German juggernaut. All right, guys. Have a good one. We'll talk to you soon.
Right. See you guys next week.
Yeah. Woo. Peace.
Bye.
Thanks, forever. Guys.